Catholic Conversations on Catholic Spirit Radio.
Hi, this is Paul Moore of the Catholic Post in Peoria, here on Catholic Conversations on Catholic Spirit Radio. Today is the first part of a two-part interview with Lindsay Wisher, freelance writer and editor and poet and author of Matchbook Night, a poetic reflection on time spent in Italy, published by Leaf Press. Born in Virginia Beach, Virginia, Lindsay moved with her parents, Julie and Joe, to Champaign in the mid-90s. Her dad served in the Navy and now works at the post office as an electronic technician. Her mom is department chair of fine and applied arts at Parkland College. Lindsay's a member of St. Matthew Parish in Champaign, and she's a 2009 graduate of the high school at St. Thomas More and a summa cum laude grad of the University of Illinois, where she earned a BA in English language and literature. Lindsay's writings have been published by Verily, Plowshares, Catholic News Service, and the Catholic Young Woman, or Young Catholic Woman, where she now serves as associate editor. Her book of poetry, Matchbook Night, was named the winner in the international category in the Overleaf Chapbook Manuscript Competition for 2017. In 2018, Lindsay received a Master of Fine Arts degree in creative writing from the University of Missouri, Kansas City, where she also worked as a composition instructor for 3 years, and she worked as an English language and literacy educator in Kansas City. Lindsay Wisher, you recently added to this resume last year by starting to write a monthly column in the Peoria Catholic Post. Mm-hmm. Just tell me how this came about.
Yeah, definitely by the grace of God. I participated in Totus Tuus as a team member way back when it first started in our diocese back in 2012. And during that summer, I first met Nancy Piccioni, and many in our diocese might know her for writing a book column for the Post. And so she introduced me to Tom Dermody, the editor. I wrote a couple articles at the beginning of 2020 and was asked to write a monthly column, which started in September. So that's kind of how that came about.
Well, that's great. It's quite very interesting. All of a sudden, I know Totus Tuus, the phrase, and and the connection with Jean-Paul. Interestingly enough, just this past weekend, I go to St. Mary of Lourdes Church, but this weekend it was at St. Mary's of Metamora, and they had a couple of they had some Totus Tuus young people there doing doing a presentation, and I actually tried to buy a T-shirt, but they apparently didn't have one any at the time. But they said they're great, so I'm planning to maybe connect with them later in the week. Lindsay, I'm tempted to follow up on that, but I won't.
Sure.
Because we'll get on to a few other things. But you know, one thing I did neglect at the beginning of this, and John, I hope this is okay, but I just wanted to say a little prayer here, a Hail Mary, if that's okay, just to kind of ground us. I drove, and I'm pretty sure Lindsay drove through some kind of pounding rain on the way here, and with God's help, we both got through that, and hope everybody else did too. So maybe just say a little simple Hail Mary here. Mm-hmm. Hail Mary, full of grace, the Lord is with thee. Blessed art thou among women, and blessed is the fruit of thy womb, Jesus. Holy Mary, Mother of God, pray for us sinners, now and at the hour of our death. Amen. God bless. Okay, great. Now you entitle your column in the Post, My Vocation is Love. Where did that come from?
Yeah, those words are spoken by St. Therese of Lisieux in her Story of a Soul. And really for me, it hits upon that universal call each of us has to love. And to me, that's one of the most important questions. How am I called to love? In the particular personal way I'm called to love, that's where I'm going to find my vocation in its fullness.
Okay. Now, St. Therese, I mean, she resounds obviously in your life. Mm-hmm. She resounds in mine, and I'm sure in the lives of in the souls and the hearts of Catholics everywhere. I keep coming back to her. I hope it's not considered ad nauseum, but I just can't help it. And there's so many books written about her. influenced or inspired by that one basic book, which I guess was a collection of things that she'd been asked to write under obligation by her sister at different times in her short life. Now, I did want to move over from that, and I'm going to connect back to that in a second, to Therese. But right now, you are a poet and freelance writer, not the easiest way to make a living. yeah. You're also a fan of Lucy Maud Montgomery. Now, she's the writer of Anne of Green Gables books, which have sold millions of copies and made all kinds of movies and TV series. Mm-hmm. I watch old movies, and I recently saw one from the 1930s with an actress whose name actually was Anne Shirley. Beautiful, beautiful rendition. But anyway, at one point, Lucy Maud Montgomery was a struggling writer. And you saw her actual typewriter. You were up in Canada in Prince Edward Island, where Lucy Maud Montgomery was from, and where I've lived myself. So obviously I have a connection here, strangely enough, in Prince Edward Island. And you saw her actual typewriter that she wrote these books on. And just as a little segue here, and I'll move it back into show the Catholic connection here in a second, but why did you come to be looking at that typewriter?
Yeah. So I attended grad school for creative writing in Kansas City. And while there, I applied for a grant to visit Prince Edward Island to do some poetic work. I kind of thought that maybe part of my creative thesis would involve some poems based on visiting Prince Edward Island. I also wanted to research more about Ellen Montgomery as a poet, because she was pretty amazingly prolific poetry-wise during her lifetime, though she did write kind of the rhymey kind of poems that are less popular today, but were incredibly popular during her life. So the University of Prince Edward Island has an L.M. Montgomery Institute and lots of resources about her life and work. And they also have a conference dedicated to L.M. Montgomery's work and life. And that happens every 2 years. So part of my proposal for this grant was researching on PEI so I could submit a paper to this conference. And so my first visit and glimpse of the typewriter happened in 2017. And then I was able to return the following year to present at the conference, kind of mapping Ellen Montgomery's poetic voice was kind of the topic I was looking at.
Yeah. I mean, so many of us, I don't think probably anybody has not seen at least some of the Lucy Maud Montgomery series, the various series that have been inspired by Anne of Green Gables. Not perhaps quite as well known to the general public, the poetic aspect of that, although there's lots of poetic kinds of sensibilities that enter into the books themselves. But you wrote a book about seeing this typewriter that she wrote on. So you wrote a poem about that experience, about seeing the actual typewriter in front of you as a writer, and that kind of quote unquote resonated with you, to use that overused word again for the second time here today. Could you read an excerpt from that poem for us? Maybe just set it up a little bit. Who you were there with a friend and at the National Historic Site there?
Yeah. I mean, both times I visited Prince Edward Island, I was blessed to have someone else come with me. The first time it was my friend Dana, who's a fellow writer, also a fellow person who got her MFA as well. She got it in fiction, whereas I got it in poetry. And so she came with me this time. The second time it was my family, but this poem, you'll hear her name. And I think that's all you need to know. We're at the heritage site where you can see kind of the Green Gables house and a lot of other things. There's a gift shop, which kind of figures into it as well. So, but yeah, I think that's all you need to know. So I'll read a little piece of this. The title is L.M. Montgomery's Typewriter. The sun regains its sky the day Dana and I spy your Empire typewriter at the Green Gables Heritage Site. White letters worn away, the ever-broken W key, and we aspiring writers marvel at your instruments of composition. At Anne conceived in faded pencil. When you revisited that notebook entry, did she come like Athena sprung from your mind, red braids flying? Fresh from the gift shop, little girls sport straw hats with Anne's braids attached. Dana and I, riveted before the typewriter, are comforted by the placard that says Anne was not published until 1908. You were 34. We have time. When we read that you hid the Anne manuscript in a hat box after a slew of rejections, we understand. Imagine the form letters that began, "Dear Miss Montgomery, we regret." Not in our readers' tastes. More for children than for our readership. I open my email to another not for us and wonder if some nights after another no, you took refuge in typing out your poems and serials in hard, swift strokes, filling the room with clatter. Did that noise, that delicious ding at the margin, sharpen your desire to open that hat box again?
Thank you very much. That's beautiful. And how would you now have any experience of typewriters that clatter and ding?
You're
such a young woman. So.
Yeah, actually, I think it was my mom's godmother. We got her typewriter, so I've definitely had some fun typing on it and playing with it. So,
yeah. I still, to the chagrin of just about everybody who's within earshot of me, since I learned on a manual typewriter to type, I hit the keys so hard that, which the computer keys don't have to be hit hard, but I can't stop, especially if I get in a bit of a rhythm. It's like a machine gun. And here's where I'm going to come back from Lucy Maud Montgomery, because it did strike me when I think of Lucy Maud, when I think of Anne of Green Gables, and I've had a lot of exposure to her. And if you live in Prince Edward Island, she was even on the license plate. My sister wasn't too crazy about that, but she's everywhere, and there's movies and there's plays and all that kind of thing. Now, do you hear a similarity between Anne of Green Gables' voice and her sensibility and that of Thérèse of Lisieux, as we were just speaking about? Do you think they might be, as Anne might say, kindred spirits?
Yes. Montgomery was actually born in 1874 and Thérèse in 1873. And so both would have probably been touched by the Romantic era of literature from the generation before them. And just from reading both of them, we can see that both delighted in the natural world. And both, I think, speak to what one Ellen Montgomery scholar refers to as poetic prose. So if you read Story of a Soul or any of the Anne books, you'll hear kind of this blend. So you're reading it in as you would read any book, so kind of that prose form, but there's kind of an elevation of language and thought that merges into kind of that poetic voice. So I do think they would have been kindred spirits,
so
definitely.
Even the phrase kindred spirits is sort of a poetic rendering, and of course many of the things that Anne would say, the lake of shining waters and all that kind of stuff. Is that a reference to an English poet? Did he write Wordsworth or somebody?
I'm
getting beyond my knowledge here, but the English romantic tradition would have been infused in her.
Yeah.
It's a little harder to figure how it would have got infused into Thérèse all alone in the monastery where she was, but definitely it was, and she seemed to embody it as much as L.M. I mean, the voices of those two, to me, to my ear, once I started thinking about it, they sounded similar.
Yeah.
And there was a similar kind of intensity, a desire for something beyond what was apparent in this realm, I guess. There was something beyond the obvious.
Yeah. And it sounds like they were both exposed to poetry, because I remember Thérèse sometimes mentioning reading John of the Cross.
Yes.
And I believe through my research, Ellen Montgomery had a little bit of exposure. She lived with her grandparents for a lot of her life, and just they had a shelf of a few books, and some of them had like some romantic poetry books. So it was interesting kind of, what might have been influences there.
Yeah, yeah. Lindsay, I think that what I'm going to ask next is a little bit of a change of pace here.
Mm-hmm.
You write poetry and prose, and how much of that decision is yours, and how much of that is the marketplace?
Well, in this day and age, I would say like almost no one can make a living on poetry alone, because just poetry markets really don't pay. And often, sometimes when you're submitting, you're asked to pay a little money for overhead. So that's kind of a, but that's definitely not why I write poetry. I guess in the sense of making money, the market orients me toward prose, but my deeper delight and the place of prayer for me is poetry. And so, I don't know, I guess in a way, poetry not making you a lot of money kind of, to me, it makes it, wow, like I want to do it for its own sake, as opposed to like, what can I get from it? It's
really
a beautiful thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Now that's sort of totally understandable, mm-hmm. that it's more important than the money, but then again, mm-hmm. we are still in the natural realm.
True. Yep. Gotta make a living.
you do have to make a living in this mm-hmm. realm. And so I would imagine that there is maybe two competitions, mm-hmm. or maybe it's not a competition. Maybe when you're inspired to write a poem, you write a poem and you write prose, maybe also when you're inspired, but also maybe when you're inspired by a deadline.
Mm-hmm.
So prose maybe has a couple of motivations.
Mm-hmm.
But then there would be a further question.
Yeah.
When does something you're writing maybe let God creep into it? Or maybe is there a market that isn't as much Catholic? Or do you even write for things that aren't Catholic? Mm. Do you even try?
Yeah, I do. I will say... someone was recently talking to me about like being a Catholic and an artist as opposed to like a Catholic artist, meaning that even when they're creating in the realm that isn't for Catholic audiences, they come as a Catholic. And so in that way, I'd say everything I write is Catholic, even when I'm writing for audiences who don't believe in God. I feel that, I guess, and also another connection to the Catholic realm is just many of the opportunities I've had have come because of connection with others. So here is a non-Catholic example of who I write for. I have a friend of mine getting her PhD in special education at the University of Kansas. And so through her, I became involved in writing and editing for a virtual reality project that will help middle and high school students with special needs grow their social skills. And so, I wouldn't have known that except through that friend. And this has allowed me to serve people in a way different than maybe writing a reflection for like the Catholic News Service or something else. So yeah, I value both opportunities because everything I write asks me to give of myself. And so there I find that kind of common ground.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Now, specifically in the example that you mentioned mm-hmm. there, you were writing something that had a good attached to it for others.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, you could say the same thing about a sister or whoever's serving in a Catholic hospital. They mm-hmm. weren't putting a dressing, they weren't putting a Catholic dressing on the person. They were mm-hmm. putting a dressing on the person. So they were doing a worldly good from a that helped people, which is in the larger sense, obviously a Christian motivation.
Mm-hmm.
We're just going to pause here for one moment mm-hmm. and say that this is Paul Moore of the Peoria Catholic Post here on Catholic Conversations on Catholic Spirit Radio, speaking with Lindsay Wisher.
You're listening to Catholic Conversations on Catholic Spirit Radio.
Mark your calendar for Monday, September 13th for the Monsignor Greg Ketchum Memorial Golf Outing at Crestwick Country Club in Bloomington. Entry fee includes green fee, golf cart, lunch, dinner, and side games. The St. Patrick Church of Myrna Knights of Columbus Golf Outing is open to men and women and will be a four-person best position contest. For details, visit our website at kfc15175.org, kfc15175.org, or call Luke at 309-825-9720.
Hi, this is Paul Moore of the Peoria Catholic Post here on Catholic Conversations and Catholic Spirit Radio, speaking with poet, editor, writer, freelance editor, Lindsay Wisher. Lindsay, you have taught creative writing or composition, perhaps, in university, and you've been an adult literacy instructor. In that particular area there, too, which, again, is secular, as we talked about before, you come to secular functions in roles with a Catholic mindset and perhaps heart set. So when you are in these roles, what have you learned?
That's a great question. I think teaching composition at the undergraduate level and adult literacy and also teaching adults English as well has taught me that writing and reading and speaking are incredibly important skills, but ones that also require a great deal of vulnerability to communicate via writing and speaking and to understand via reading. One has to pass through moments of incomprehension and lack of understanding. And it actually reminds me a great deal of the poetic journey, in that I can guess even among those listening here today, there are probably a handful of us who feel that they just don't get poetry. They may tell themselves, I'm not good at it, or it isn't for me. In high school, many of us were taught to dissect poems to find the metaphors and rhyme schemes and struggled to find a meaning in the poem. And when they attempted to find a meaning, someone told them, no, you're wrong. And so the feeling is, well, I'm just not an expert. And that's a similar feeling for some of my students that I've had in the past. They've had similar experiences in the reading writing realms. They're just like, wow, I can't do this. I'm not good at it. So my work as a teacher was to make the process of writing and reading and speaking a more engaging task, and one that didn't end in failure to understand, one in which there was ample support and room to revise and try again. And those things were prized over perfectly understanding the first time around. And so I guess this teaching orientation is akin to what I now tell people about poetry. It's not about understanding every word or image. To me, it's more like looking at a sunset. You're not typically like pondering the natural science behind a sunset, right, when you're looking at it. That'd be cool if you are, but I think many people are just like, wow, you're more likely kind of marveling at the beauty. And that's the way I endeavor to approach teaching. What can you enjoy and how can we enjoy the process together? That can get a little tough with a gen ed composition class, but we try. So,
yeah. My wife teaches adult literacy and numeracy, and you mentioned there the vulnerability of the reader and the writer. Mm-hmm. She often has a challenge getting students, and this is adult ed. Yeah. These are back of the class kids from junior high and high school. They didn't read voluntarily. If the teacher asked if somebody was going to read, their hand did not go up. So in the classes that my wife has, there's sometimes a reluctance to get anybody to read.
Yeah.
Because they feel the vulnerability even of maybe not sounding like I complimented you during the break on how you read your poem. It was beautifully felt, and there was no, you know, there was no lack of confidence in your ability to deliver it. Mm. And the students, even if they're not writing something of their own, but maybe even more with something of their own, they are reticent to do it because they feel that they are exposing themselves to not being in control and not being good readers and feeling like that little kid who's still kind of not good enough or a failure in some way and who's going to be corrected.
Yeah.
And I also note what you talked about when you said the poetic journey.
Mm-hmm.
I thought you were going to say, because I always imagine what people are going to say before they say it. I thought you were going to say the faith journey, because you're going through these periods of uncertainty, and then you're going trying to get these rocks in the stream to step on to get across to your next place of seeming solidity before you move on, before you venture, take a step again. So the faith journey and the poetic journey and reading, and I can see how these things are, you know, everything is of a piece, I guess.
Yeah. Certainly.
Yeah. Okay. I'll stop ruminating there and ask another question. Now, you love to travel, and your book of poetry, Matchbook Night, was based on a trip to Italy.
Mm-hmm.
Can you please explain the title?
Yeah. In the summer of 2014, I lived with a Sicilian family as an English tutor. And it was a really lovely experience. It was a month of just sharing life with them. I feel like we did a little more vacationing than me actually tutoring them, but that was beautiful. So I was visiting in late July, early August of that year, and Mount Etna, which is an active volcano in the region, was going through a period of activity. So during the night, I could see kind of a ribbon of molten lava coming down the volcano sides. And in the mornings, the cobblestones would be covered with a layer of ash. And throughout the day, a sound like thunder would shake the ground, even when it was like sunny. So for the Sicilians living in this region, this wasn't extraordinary. For me, I was like, are we okay? And we were fine. So Matchbook Night is a small book of poetry, which is called a chapbook. And it kind of remembers my time there. And the title really is referring to Etna, that geographic beacon of the region that lit up the night.
Would you mind, or would you be able to read a little excerpt from one of the poems in Matchbook Night?
Yeah. So I'm going to read to you one that... So when I stayed with this family, we often visited their friends. They were very kind in kind of integrating me into their life and the things they were doing. So there was one day when we were near the sea, and the kids who were around were climbing up this really big rock and jumping into the water. And they invited me to do that too. And it kind of just reminds me of like the act of faith. It was kind of a tangible vision of like what it means sometimes to step in faith into the unknown, to literally like fall through the air and hope that the water will catch you. And so this poem is called Fledgling. The name you'll hear, I think you'll hear Bianca, and that was a child of my host family's friends. So, Fledgling. Climbing higher above sun-sown sea, Bianca. Summer feet calloused against the pumice of Pillow Rock. Who knows how long this lavic tower has lived in the Ionian, crusted with salt, mossy in the shady spaces where birds and barnacles make their nests. Unafraid, she climbs closer to her father, who sits at the pinnacle, watching. The children have been jumping from the rock into the water, the distance between filled with the scratch of the gull voices against the naked air, veil through which shrieking children fall. And suddenly a jumper disappears into liquid silence. Sun the compass paints the surface with light. And then resurrection. Exultant face, gilded, saint-like rises. Now swims toward the rock again. Bianca finds her father's hand. She's ready to climb cliff faces with him, but for a moment she needs his grip, a steadying stone, for the furious flight into abandonment.
That's lovely, lovely. Very, very nice there, Lindsay, again.
Thank you.
So now another trip that you took, other than Italy, and an extended visit, saw you working alongside the missionaries of charity in India.
Mm-hmm.
And you actually, you wrote about that in a previous issue of the Catholic Post. So how has that experience informed your writing?
Yeah, that is a good question. This trip also led me to write a series of poems, though most of these remain unpublished. It was a really beautiful trip that had many beautiful and difficult moments. So kind of just still processing, really. But yeah, the trip included cultural appreciation, mission work, and pilgrimage, and was led by a man who's now my friend. His name is Anand Bimarasetty. He's a former Focus missionary and founder of Project Finding Calcutta, which is a ministry that invites those who serve invites us to serve in our own communities. So to find the poorest of the poor within our own towns, neighborhoods, and communities. So definitely check that out. He also typically takes post-college adults to India once a year. And so I traveled with Anand and a group of post-college adults at the end of 2018 and into early 2019. And so the first part of our trip was kind of seeing some cultural sites like the Taj Mahal. Second part was doing the mission work with the Missionaries of Charity. And then the third part was the pilgrimage part. We went south to the state of Kerala, where the Apostle St. Thomas first came when he brought the gospel to India. As I said, this trip was so many things. It was beautiful, intense, wearying, edifying. In terms of the trip's effects on my writing, I think I've just become more convinced than ever about the universality of our faith. And also ways in which we in the U.S. can learn from other countries. Something that I really took from this visit to India was the importance of both our immediate family and extended family as a present part of one's support network and life. I think it's easy in America, kind of this mark of individualism is to move away and to go, which isn't always a bad thing, but I love that there are other ways of doing things in other places. And I think that was just a reminder to stay curious about the world and to delight in the differences.
I'm reminded as you said that of I had a boss once who approached me. Now, I know that Mother Teresa was passed away maybe before when you were still a child, let alone when you mm-hmm. went to mm-hmm. India.
Yeah.
I think she died in 1997, I believe. There was something that was written about Mother Teresa afterwards by somebody who wasn't too fond of Catholics. I forget what his name. He's a well-known skeptic. Mm-hmm. In any event, there was articles at a certain point when they were memorializing Mother Teresa, and people were saying lots of nice things about her, as they should. With God's help, it's all true. This mm-hmm. gentleman had written a book. You know, what Mother Teresa actually did was not so good, maybe. She didn't attack the root causes of poverty. And, you know, if you look at all these things she did around the world, she basically made an industry of poverty. And mm-hmm. so my boss approached me. He knew mm-hmm. I was a Catholic. And he said, how do you respond to that, Paul, that she made an industry? He said, I've always liked her. I've always thought she's kind of good. But you know, this guy, I got to admit, this article has me scratching my head. Where mm-hmm. wherever she goes, poverty goes, kind of thing. And she's kind of, it's almost like a busybody who's finding her reason to be in almost, you know, exploiting poverty as opposed to trying to be a healing force in the face of it. Mm-hmm. I must admit, I was nonplussed. I didn't quite know what to say, other than, you know, some people are always willing to be critical of anything. I certainly did feel a little bit of the way that the devil works in mm-hmm. very sort of insidious, subtle ways mm-hmm. in trying to undermine good mm-hmm. by saying, gee, maybe that's not so good after all. Do you have any response? I know this is off book and everything, but do you have any response to that kind of how you would feel about that kind of how you might have answered him better than I did?
Wow, that's a good question. I what's coming to mind, and I can't quite place what this comes from, is just that story of walking along the beach. I don't know if it's two people, and someone is. There's so many starfish on the beach, and this person is one by one throwing the starfish back into the water. And the companion says, well, there's so many starfish. How are you going to get them all into the water? And the person says something along the lines of, well, I can help this one. And I think that was Mother Teresa's approach, is to see the individual and to help the individual. And yes, poverty is huge. But I think she was there also to be a presence and a hope, because I think that oftentimes hope is the first thing that goes when there is when there is difficulty. And so I think she recognized more than many people today that poverty just exists in so many forms, and that, yeah, recovering that hope is something that she's at least taught me so far.
Yeah, and I think that she also, didn't she kind of say many times that the greatest poverty is loneliness, and that mm-hmm. that existed in all the mm-hmm. cultures, even the richer ones like mm-hmm. North America, mm-hmm. where people might have had their physical needs taken care of to a minimal extent, mm-hmm. but could still be isolated. And I'm thinking particularly of the elderly, could be isolated. Yeah. And as far as officialdom would be concerned, they were taken care of. They weren't starving. They weren't this and they weren't that, although sometimes that situation is not exactly certain either. But she would say, you know, this poverty exists even in the West. People are lonely. Mm-hmm. And that family connection that you mentioned, that in India, you know, the family, it never lets go, and people don't necessarily, they don't want to let go, although there are times, obviously, when they probably wouldn't mind their independence. But there's never fear. That's a continuum. And here in North America, that continuum can leave people in an apartment in a city half a continent away from their kids and quite lonely. I live in a retirement community myself, or we live part time in a retirement community. I know that there can be certainly loneliness there among mm-hmm. older people. Lindsay, I think we'll just take one more little break here.
Sounds great.
This is Paul Moore of Peoria Catholic Post here on Catholic Conversations on Catholic Spirit Radio with editor, writer, and poet Lindsay Wisher.
You're listening to Catholic Conversations on Catholic Spirit Radio.
You most likely are familiar with Fatima and Lourdes, but did you know that the Blessed Virgin also appeared in the United States in 1859? That apparition took place near Champion, a small town in the Door Peninsula of Wisconsin. Today, Champion is home to the National Shrine of Our Lady of Good Help. Join Catholic Spirit Radio the weekend of August 14th and 15th on its pilgrimage to this shrine. Our travels will also take us to the Basilica and National Shrine of Mary, Help of Christians, at Holy Hill, also in Wisconsin. This two-day bus trip departs from Wapella, Bloomington, and El Paso. The cost for the trip is $300 per person. Make plans to join this exciting pilgrimage by visiting CatholicSpiritRadio.com or calling Kathy at 309-828-6554 or Carolyn at 309-830-4164.
Hi, this is Paul Moore of the Peoria Catholic Post here on Catholic Conversations on Catholic Spirit Radio with Lindsay Wisher, who is also one of my fellow columnists on the Catholic Post. But Lindsay is a poet as well, and a writer and an editor, and has been a teacher and probably will be again if she isn't currently a teacher and instructor. Lindsay, now, on that trip and extended visit that you wrote, that you went to and to the Missionaries of Charity in India, and that you wrote about later, mm-hmm. You mentioned that it informed your writing by expanding your idea of the world. How does that kind of idea how does that play into the aspect of being a Catholic? In that particular culture, for instance, you're a woman in any culture. Mm-hmm. So in that culture, did you find that being a Catholic young woman put you in a particular segment that kind of put you to the side, that you were considered, maybe because you were Western too, you weren't from India, mm-hmm. that you were considered in a different way? And of course, you were different. But how did the people of India act toward you, the people that you might be working with in mission?
Sure. Well, I think something I noticed, and it's probably from being an outsider, because India is incredibly rich in terms of the different, like people can come from different states and different regions, and there's so many different languages. And So there are probably a lot of subtle differences between people from different regions that I wouldn't have noticed. But yeah, that being said, like I definitely knew that I looked different. And I think there was also, and this was just something I hadn't experienced, is some people wanted to take pictures with us because we did look very different and we stood out. One of the people who went on this trip had extremely blonde hair. And so I watched someone when we were at the Taj Mahal kind of go up and touch it because it was just, it was so different. I'd say mostly my experience with the people of India is that they helped us. They saw that we were different. And, you know, once we were on a train going toward a smaller town, and they were, even though they didn't speak our language and we didn't speak theirs, they kept saying the station that they thought we were going to us, and were trying to kind of guide us when we were getting off. So I think there was a sense of, okay, like, we see you, and yeah, we want to help you figure out what to do. So yeah, I appreciated that a lot.
Yeah, yeah. Now it's certainly a very welcoming attitude. Whether or not they knew that you were missionaries or not, probably on the train might not have been. They might not have been aware of that. Just that you were culturally different.
Sure.
But can you tell me now? And now, Mother Teresa, it's well known that she was loved by the Indian people. That she was. There had been a history of colonialism in India, which wasn't as appreciated. And lots of times, as we know, in cultures that have been absorbed, I guess, that have been part of various empires, mm-hmm. The faith aspect that can be brought by missionaries is sometimes resented.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Mother Teresa seemed to be grandfathered a goodwill clause so that she was absolved from that, and the Indian people saw her goodwill. And even if they were of different faiths, mm-hmm. they, at least from what I've heard, she didn't actually get active resistance, or at least after things got going, there was no kind of irritation against her. Did you sense, and I asked you to be quite honest in this, that
sure.
some of the Indian people maybe that was wearing off, or that they didn't appreciate the missionaries, even if the missionaries are trying to do good things? I'm not trying to be negative. I'm just kind of trying to wonder what the Indian context is there.
Well, I mean, in Kolkata itself, there is such a rich blend. We would wake up in the morning and there was the Muslim call to prayer. And at the same time, there are a lot of Westerners in the area who are coming to help the missionaries of charity. They have had, of course, before the pandemic, like a lot of people coming through from a lot of different countries. And what I didn't realize about Calcutta also is that it's one of the richest places in India. It is kind of like many of our cities. There is a mix of extreme poverty and a lot of wealth. Mm. And so that was something I learned in retrospect, because we were really only focused on a certain part of the city. And that actually was what made my experience in India perhaps different from other experiences I've had before, because I was aware of perhaps, like, did it just look like I was coming in to, like, help people, whereas maybe that wasn't wanted. Maybe the people would rather help themselves.
Mm.
But I don't think I got that sense necessarily from the people themselves. I think at least the people in the areas we walked through were pretty used to seeing kind of the stream of, like, Westerners, like, walking toward mm-hmm. the various, like, work sites and stuff. But I don't know. It's a question I did have myself, and I do hope that we did good. But yeah, I don't know. It's something that I wonder about. But I do love that that Mother Teresa's sisters, beyond everything that could be a division, they go straight to the person. They go straight to, this person is in need, and so I want to help fill their need.
Yeah.
And so that's just a reminder to me, just here back in the States now, it's like there can be so many things that maybe become an excuse for not helping others. There are a lot of divisions that can happen. We live in a very polarized time, but yet the person is first, you know?
Yeah.
Person first, and everything else about them fades back in a way because they are made in the image of God.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, that to me is supremely hopeful about the work we do, whether that's in whatever vocation we have.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Now, you mentioned that the image that struck me there was, you said the missionaries go straight to the person. Mm-hmm. And that did remind me of a very Christ-like intention and a very Christ-like motivation that they, if you will, they see the person.
Mm-hmm.
And so, referring to what I'd asked before, with a little bitterness, perhaps, about my old boss's question about Mother Teresa didn't fix the whole problem of poverty, didn't fix the quote-unquote systemic causes. They aren't looking for systemics or systems. They're mm-hmm. going to the person. And there's, of course, a place for mm-hmm. people who want to try to fix the system mm-hmm. and in a good way for people. Nobody's yeah. denying that. Christ said, the yeah. poor will always be with you. You can help them all you'd like to.
Yeah.
But going to the person must feel to the person like it kind of goes past, oh, they're a Christian, and perhaps they would like me to accept Jesus Christ for my sake, but they're not giving me that right now. Right now, they're just sure. giving me the fact that I have a wound in my arm or that I sure. need a bed to lie on that's clean. So I can feel that. Is that the kind of intention that they would focus on them? They wouldn't. Is that what you're communicating? Or
Yeah, of course, well, at least in my own mind, like when you are a Catholic, I think that universality, you embrace the world, but you also let the world embrace you, because I think what I really loved about this trip was it wasn't just going on like a mission trip. That's why I'm having a hard time classifying it, because it had so many pieces. And I love that the cultural appreciation piece of it came first, because it was a reminder of like, I'm not coming in here to do something for someone else. I'm here to learn. Mm. I'm here to be small and to realize there are so many things about the world I don't know. And there's so much about the world that I can be taught if I'm willing to be a student. And so I appreciated that a lot. And I think that, yeah, just that sense of curiosity toward people. And I experienced that too when I worked in adult literacy. My students were experts in things that I wasn't an expert mm-hmm. in, even if reading was the hard thing. So just always remembering that every person has something to teach us, as something that they know that I don't know. And I think that makes me excited to meet people and to learn about them. So I think that thinking about the experience in India, the moments that were the best were the ones where I got out of my own way, stopped worrying about the little things, and let myself be, yeah, embraced by the culture around me.
So. Yeah, mm-hmm. yeah. Yeah. I'm thinking, I'm moving, just segueing over a little bit to mm-hmm. charity in general, mm-hmm. personal, organized or whatever. I'm just thinking on a personal basis that I get these letters asking for assistance for different things, mm-hmm. and when you respond to one of those letters, then the charitable organization is likely to sell or give your name to other charities, and then you get all of these kinds of letters, maybe many, you know, on a daily basis or weekly basis.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And I guess I'm just curious, as a fellow Catholic and Christian, do you get these kinds of letters? Do you get these? And how would you respond to a sort of, speaking of charity, how do you respond to the fact that you as a person, even if you did have Bill Gates type of money, could not give money to everybody? What do you do with the, how do you, and this is a complete segue from what we've been talking about, sure. but how does one, for instance, not in a sense stop one's charitable efforts, but how do you in particular, as a young person with limited means, I guess, or not unlimited means, if you will, how do you respond to that kind of thing?
Sure. I remember I was on an arts council board in Kansas City, and I remember it was a very brief time I was on it, but they talked a lot about in-kind donations. So a lot of times, yeah, you don't have money or a lot of it, but you can give of yourself. And I think you're right. Like there are many more causes and many more needs than a single person can fill. But I think that that's where that discerning where your universal vocation to love is specifically calling you and kind of allowing God to lead. I know for me, the first few years out of undergrad was supporting in small ways focused missionaries because they were my friends, people that I knew. And now as time goes on, I'm kind of discerning like, well, where might God be asking me to like volunteer my time? There will be times too when I'm asked to give financially as well. But I think it is all discernment, and it is,
Well, even though, and I'll take your point there, and I'll make it harder for you. Even if you're not talking about money, if you're talking about time. That's perhaps even more limited than financial resources by times. And I'm sure that somebody like yourself, for instance, here today, you're coming here and you're talking on the radio, and this isn't not a paid quote unquote gig.
Sure.
So, but this is something you do for your faith and as an expression of your faith. How do you decide what sort of things you say yes to in that? When I'm sure a lot of the people that approach you say, well, you'll probably be interested in this. You're a quote unquote young Catholic woman, which I'm sure the phrase probably bothers you after a while, but you're in this category. This is something that you would probably be interested in, and you don't have a family yet, so you've got lots of time, so you can do this. So how do you respond to that kind of suggestion?
Well, I start by not responding. I would probably first take a little time to think about it and say, like, well, thank you. I appreciate that compliment, and let me think on this and pray on this. So, yeah. Definitely. It is a discernment, and it is, again, I think asking God, what are the one or two things I can do, maybe apart from like the work I might also be called to do, that I can serve you well, and let him guide on that. It is hard because we are asked. I'd say no matter what state in life you're in, you're probably asked a lot for a lot of things. And I think as at least Midwestern Americans, we have a hard time saying no. And that is also sometimes by personality. But it's okay to say no for a greater yes. God might be calling you to make more time for something else. And so, that is a discernment. That's a very personal thing. So, yeah.
So, well, and I'm going to ask more of you in a sense. We're going to do another show after this one.
Okay, sounds good.
And if that's okay, if you don't, if you please don't say no to that at this point.
I won't.
So what I'd like to say is that thank you very much, Lindsay Wisher, for today's installment. This is Paul Moore of the Peoria Catholic Post, and Lindsay's a Catholic Post writer as well, here on Catholic Conversations on Catholic Spirit Radio. Now, as we close up this this episode, I'd just like to indicate that in our next episode, speaking with Lindsay, we'll mention talk a little bit more about Catholic Young Woman, the online platform that she's an assistant editor for. I'd also like to remind you that Lindsay has written a book, a chap book called chapter book, if you will, Matchbook Night. It's a book of poetry, and that's available from Leaf Press, leaf as in leaves falling from the trees, Leaf Press. Just in closing here, John Hall is executive producer of Catholic Conversations, and Weber's associate producer. We're here, I believe it's going to be on the show streams on the Catholic Spirit website, Saturday and Sundays at 3 p.m. Is that still the time, John? And or you can listen to the podcast, and please share the link. And as Mother Teresa, who we were quoting, or Lindsay was mentioning today, would say, God bless and good luck. This is Paul Moore on Catholic Conversations, today having spoken with Catholic Post columnist and poet Lindsay Wisher.
You've been listening to Catholic Conversations. Download our podcasts at CatholicSpiritRadio.com.